Actor William Finley passed away on April 14, 2012. We spoke to Mr. Finley in 2007 as part of our tribute to director Brian De Palma. Mr. Finley started his career with Mr. De Palma way back in their college days at Sarah Lawrence. Ultimately, he would collaborate with Mr. De Palma on 9 projects, including Murder a la Mode, The Wedding Party, Dionysus, Sisters, Phantom of the Paradise, The Fury, Dressed to Kill, and The Black Dahlia.
Mr. Finley, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi, thanks for being with us tonight.
Yeah,
sure, it was a treat to be here.
Thank you. Chris, the stage is all yours.
All right, thank you. Mr. Finley, can I ask you how your relationship with De Palma developed at Sarah Lawrence College? What was it that brought the two of you together?
Well, what brought us together was we originally went to Columbia College, and the year we went was the year the theater burned down. So we had nothing to. There was nothing at Columbia, literally, to do that originally got us to Columbia to begin with. So we decided that. Well, we heard that Sarah Lawrence needed some male actors. At that time, it was a female school. And we headed up to Bronxville and proceeded to take over the theater department with the help of the main teacher there, who was named Wilfred Leach, who was, of course, the progenitor of Winslow. And a big influence on Brian and myself. He was teaching film. He was teaching 16mm, how to make films, how to act in films, history of films, things that we were really dying to find out about. And at that time in history, there was very little you could do to study these things. It's not like now where every school has a film program. And some are just dedicated to film itself. So basically we started studying movies and plays, historic like Stravinsky and Yeats, and just wonderful theatrical masters together. And then came back to Columbia and started a drama club there, which then imported Sarah Lawrence to Columbia.
Oh, okay. And then you started making the short films with him. Like in the early days, you made the film. It's Wotan's Wake. Is that
right?
How
right. Wotan's Wake is again. When you see it now, it looks rather strange. Then it looked rather amazing. It was like a real art film. But in the art film, were satires of sort of. Art films of the time, like Dolce Vita and Blow Up, for the first Antonioni, which I can't even remember the name of, had Phantom of the Opera in it, Godzilla. It's just a pastiche that made a lot of references through very obscure movies at the time. Wonderful movie.
At that time, was he already the sure-handed, uncompromising director that we know him to be now?
No, he was. He's stylistically, he's always had a really good idea of what he wanted to do, and that film was based on German Expressionism, black and white, very jagged edges, lighting, odd lighting, moving lighting, cracked mirrors. If you see it, you'd understand. It's very Caligari-like. So that's what got him going. The look of films, the way they look.
Well, that comes across.
You know, it shows up in a lot of other of his films later on, including the last one, Black Dahlia.
It does. You're right. You've known him probably longer than anyone else in his professional career. How do his films reflect his personality?
They're very much like him. He's they have very cool exteriors. They usually have a heart in the middle of them, and it's very, very open and warm. The look, of course, so he's very complicated, almost too complicated. I mean, I was listening to your last guest talk about, you know, how critics rejected him. They did seize upon his treatment of women and the supposed borrowings from Hitchcock, but when you get right down to it, even if you look at Sisters, which is obviously, you know, influenced heavily by Hitchcock, they're not the same things. There's a psycho-like killing, but that's as far as it gets. There's nothing about a Siamese twin ever in Hitchcock.
Right.
They sort of
absolutely
seized on this thing and stuck it to him for his whole career, which I think was unfair.
Oh, very unfair.
And now it's, of course, everybody's supposed to go out and borrow from everybody.
Yeah.
So it's a different thing. But then they literally pasted him over with this. And every picture they tried to find out what he might have borrowed from something. So it became like the tagline for De Palma, much to his regret. I mean, it's just, it's a shame.
Yeah, it's really unfair.
Because I think he's one of the most original, certainly of that era, filmmakers. There's nobody who makes films except maybe Marty.
Mm-hmm.
Scorsese, who's given anything to films that took them forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to ask you. You mentioned Sisters, which you of course were in, but right after Sisters in 1974 was The Phantom of the Paradise.
Right.
And the film has, first of all, let me say that I love the film.
Great.
And it has this gigantic cult following, specifically in Winnipeg, where we received these really excited emails from some fans of the movie that are telling us that Winnipeg, they have a festival for the movie. They love the movie.
Of course, it's self-serving, but the Winnipeg people are what are the audience that were supposed to be for the film. They're supposed to be nationwide for the film. I mean, they were very intelligent. They got the references. They were hooked by the story. They didn't think it was a farce. They didn't think it was ridiculous. They loved the music, because Winnipeg's a big music town for Canada, the biggest probably. And it's so heartwarming to get that appreciation from people. But, you know, what you put into it, finally, 25 years, 30 years later, it comes back to you.
Right.
So my problem with that is that I never got Brian to go up there so he could feel it. Mm. All he's had is the fans in France, you know, the adulation in France.
Right.
Where, you know, standing ovations for Brian. But he's never had it in America or close to America.
No, it's sad.
And it's very sad. But I couldn't get him to come up. He didn't want to for some reason.
So, but you went.
Oh, yeah. Well, the whole cast went.
Yeah.
The second year of Fantapalooza, the whole cast went up there, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, and they all had a really good time. I mean, they were all shocked how much fun it was.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it was like Beatlemania. I can't explain it. It sounds absolutely crazy, but people are standing on their seats screaming.
Oh, we believe it.
It's unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. But boy, what a thrill.
We were speaking earlier about his earlier films, Greetings, Hi Mom, and how they were mostly comedic and satirical.
Right.
Do you notice the presence of that comedy and the satire in his films still?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest things he gave to horror, or the genre, he's not really a horror director, but he, in his early years, he was supposed to be a horror director, the master of the macabre.
Right.
But his thing was really quite wonderful. In those days, nobody laughed at a horror film. You laughed at them sometimes, but you never laughed during them. There was never intentionally, you know, the closest thing was Igor and the James Whale, you know, Frankensteins.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But never were you supposed to go to a horror film and find anything ridiculous. And so in Sisters, we did a cleanup scene. It was like a commercial. You know, a very bloody murder. It's like someone coming in after Psycho and doing a cleanser commercial. I mean, he took, you know, a long time doing this. A lot of screen time watching somebody clean up a murder.
Right.
With we used every kind of product we could think of. A lot of fun, and we were laughing all the time, and it was very funny.
You were in his first feature film, in Murder a la Mode.
Yeah.
And you were in his most recently released film, The Black Dahlia. So how do you see that he's changed as a filmmaker over the years?
Well, now he has, in those days he was just a kid, and he didn't have the respect, you know, he had to prove himself with the crew every time.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's literally like a master that comes on the set. You know, it's like Fellini comes in the room, and nobody's saying, well, shouldn't you put the camera over there, or, you know, wouldn't it be better if we mic'd it here, or how about if we cut the scene there? You know, well, it's going on too long. Why don't we drop this tracking shot? It's costing too much. None of that now. I mean, if there are any kind of those battles, they're all behind the scenes before the film is made, you know, what the costs are. And he's got very good producers, so they fend off any problems. So he's much more relaxed, you know. He can deal with the actors. He can joke, which is unheard of. In the beginning, he never joked about anything because it was too hard to keep all the balls in the air. I mean, one of the hardest things about directing is just finding out where every little thing goes and keeping it in your mind. So now he can sort of keep it in his mind. He doesn't even use storyboards anymore, hardly at all.
Oh, really?
The last one I remember that was really heavily storyboarded was Mission Impossible, where he knew where all the slide points are, all the big adventure points were, and they were heavily storyboarded.
So what about with actors? I mean, does he enjoy working with actors?
He's really started to like working with actors. He, has actors return to do parts for him over and over. He's very comfortable with actors. I haven't been on a set when he's had a difficult time with an actor in a long time.
What about ad-libbing? I mean, happy accidents and things like that. Does he allow for that during the
season? I would say less, but I'm sure on something like Redacted, he's fine with the accidents. See, Redacted is another, he's going back to the rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's all ready to shoot, he's got the scene ready to go. They all know everything about the scene that there is, and they've improvised whatever they're going to add to it.
How does he direct? Is it through suggestion, or is there a lot of detailed talk about crafting the character? Or
if an actor needs that, he'll go do it. He'll sit down. He'll go, work with Josh Harnett if he has questions about how to do some, like a major part. They'll go over it as carefully as they want or any direction he wants to go.
Right.
But generally, he lets people do what they do, as long as they know what marks they have to hit and where the camera's going
right.
to be.
Now, what about the two of you? Do you guys have kind of a shorthand on the set? You've known each other for so long and worked together so often.
Yeah, I can tell when he didn't like a take before he even says he doesn't like a take.
Right, right.
You know, you can tell how quick he's moving, how tired he is, or there, I wouldn't say there's a code, but there's definitely, once you've worked with him, you have an idea of how he works and what he wants.
Oh, yeah. I know this is the last question we got to ask. I know it's hard to be objective because you've been in so many of them, but
yeah.
Do you have a favorite De Palma film?
I've been watching Untouchables over and over. I can't, you know, it's like one of those films. I mean, I'm a sucker for things like Die Hard.
Right.
Where you can sort of go in at any time and watch it and have a good time. You don't have to start from the beginning and sit there in front of your tube and watch a whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So I think at the moment my favorite is Untouchables because it just, you can go in anywhere in that movie and it's good anywhere.
There's a lot of great dialogue in that film.
I mean, a lot of people don't like it that much, but I think it's a wonderful.
Oh, I love it.
Absolutely wonderful. And it's in the whole, it has his new stuff and his old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just got everything in it. You know, it's like, I wish he could make more of them. I wish, you know, they would write things that were as good as that.
Right,
and he would direct everything as good as that because
right.
He would be incredible. I mean, just so amazing if it was possible to do. I don't know anybody who's gotten it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anybody of that generation who's continued. Brian's doing pretty good.
He absolutely has.
Yes,
it's just astonishing.
He's very much survived, and he's still so vital. And
yeah, the bad part is the critics. That's why he's just never got that.
They stick on something, the critics, and especially in this country, and they just, you know, it's like almost like, okay, memo, when a Brian De Palma film comes out, say this, and, you know.
Right.
It's sad and unfair.
Well, you know, and the other ridiculous thing is, if anybody needs a lifetime award from an Oscar kind of thing, it's him. You know, I think Marty, obviously, Spielberg, obviously, Coppola's gotten it already.
Yeah, but he does.
But he deserves something, and he's not getting it.
No, he's not. It's
no.
Bad.
I'm so shocked.
We wanted to give him a little of it tonight. I mean,
well, that's good. I'm glad you guys are keeping it up. I mean,
just
the websites, too. The websites are wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And fortunately, we have one of the top critics in the country with us in just a moment. He's on the line, and he's a big De Palma devotee. So
who do you got?
Mr. Armand White.
Oh, Armand. Well, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, say hello.
So we're all united here.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Thank
okay,
you so
well,
much,
pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Finley.
Okay.
And you're welcome back on the show anytime.
Well, okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.